mark something since we're using a new book. I can't go to page numbers like that. My name is Deb. I'm a real alcoholic. Hi. My sobriety date is March 15th, 1987, and for that I'm incredibly grateful to each and every one of you, particularly those of you who've been sober longer than I have and you are there to keep the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous open. Thank you so much for your service. Man, step three. Lynn, wow, do I have to follow that? And then, you know, and then Hillary gets up and sings. And I mean, how many singers can pull that off? I mean, really, really. And then singing Ave Maria, that's just, whew. So what an incredible start to an incredible weekend. And I'm just so, I'm very, very grateful to be a part of this. When Polly called and asked if I would put this on my calendar, I, of course, Polly called. you know, what's the answer when Polly calls? Yes, ma'am. You know, I learned that 28 years ago. You know, when certain gals call, you just say yes, ma'am. And so I put it on my calendar, and I knew that this was going to be a very, very special spring for me. And I had to arrange some dates in my life to be here this weekend, and then I'm going to just tell you a little bit about that before I get started talking about step three specifically. There's a walk across central Spain, and it's called the Camino de Santiago, and many of you are nodding up and down because you've heard of it. Maybe someone else out there has done it. But I just got back on Wednesday from walking 500 miles across Spain. And it's an ancient pilgrimage route. And I can honestly tell you that 28 years ago, when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, hopeless, friendless, and godless, that arranging my life and taking all the extra steps necessary so that I could take 6 weeks out and fly halfway across the world so that I could spend some time shedding life so that I could be closer to my God was not on my list. Absolutely not on my list. And so when Hillary got up and sang Ave Maria, I just heard Ave Maria being sung in an ancient church that was built in the 6th century a couple of weeks ago with the Bishop of Sevilla. And I would just, you know, it's just all coming together and it's just absolutely amazing. And I'm still on my pilgrimage because the pilgrimage starts when you leave home and it doesn't end until you arrive home again. And so on Wednesday, I flew into JFK and I got to spend the last day and a half at Stepping Stones. And then today I flew down here. So I haven't been home in 6 weeks. So you ladies are actually welcoming me home, and you're helping me finish my pilgrimage. So for that, I say thank you again. Oh, okay, I told you, my sobriety date is March 15th, 1987, and for that, I'm incredibly grateful. And I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous just following a very, very solid run right through the middle of alcoholism. By the time I ended up getting sober, I had only been drinking for 6 years. I started drinking when I was 9. I got sober when I was 15. And by the time I got sober when I was 15 years old, I had been drinking the clock round. I was unable to draw a sober breath. I was absolutely a daily drinker, and I was chasing it hard. And for me, every single time I swallowed alcohol, it just flipped that switch in me that just said more, more, more. I was physically addicted to alcohol, and I was really in a pretty hopeless state of mind and body. And I got delivered into the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say I got delivered into the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I believe that that's what happens to us. I believe that alcoholics have the opportunity that we get delivered to the doorstep, of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God the day I got delivered to that doorstep, there was someone who was standing by the door. They took my hand, they put my hand on that doorknob, and they helped me open the door and walk all the way in. And on March 15th, I walked all the way into Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat all the way down and I stayed. And I didn't know when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, when I walked all the way in and sat all the way down and stayed, I didn't know that you guys were going to deliver me into the arms of God. I had no idea that that's where I was headed. What I knew was that I couldn't drink anymore and have any kind of success in my life. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't drink anymore and have any success in any area of my life. I was drinking the clock round. I was absolutely off the hook. And I became convinced that I was physically addicted to that stuff and that drinking was not an option, but I didn't know how to get through life without drinking. I didn't know that recovery from alcoholism was going to require me to not only find or to define some concept of God that I could believe in, but that I was actually going to have to take action on that belief, action with that concept of God, and I was going to have to enter into a trusting give-and-take relationship with that higher power. I had no idea. So for those of you who are brand new, just cover your ears. Because that would have been way too much information for me when I was brand new. I would have gone running from the room like my hair was on fire. Like, I just want to quit drinking. I just want to quit drinking. You know, what an order. I can't go through with it. And I really didn't know what I had in store. I really didn't. And some of those people who took my hand and put my hand on the doorknob and helped me open the door and come all the way into Alcoholics Anonymous, they were very, very gentle with me in delivering me into that relationship with God. What they did for me was they allowed me to experience the love and the grace of God by simply doing what they said they were going to do when they said they were going to do it. You know, there was this group of people in this tiny little town where I was living right outside of Akron, Ohio. And they had taken me on as a charge. They had had a group conscience meeting. I'm going to have to tell you this story real quick. So I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got into a little bit of a jam. It happens. So I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. So I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. My sister's going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. She's been doing drugs. She hasn't been drinking, so she's not hearing her story. I'm going to AA meetings because if I don't, she'll tell. And, you know, and I am sober against my will. And I hate Alcoholics Anonymous because you guys speak a language I don't understand. And it's just blah, 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 blah. I'm 15 years old. You all are super old. And I have absolutely no desire to hang out with you whatsoever. So I go to every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous late. I walk in up through the middle of the room and make as much noise as possible. I don't even like coffee at the time, but I have 3 cups at every meeting. Up, down, up, down, up, down. I take smoke breaks. I didn't even smoke when I got here, but I learned. I'm an absolute wreck in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And people are looking at me like, what is she doing? Like, why is she even here? And so, and mind you, I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Akron, Ohio. They tend to take their AA a little seriously. I don't know that I'm going to AA in the Mecca of AA. You know what I mean? Like, who cares? I mean, it's just a stupid town with these stupid meetings with these old people in it. And, man, then they talk about stuff I don't understand. And what is the... But here I go. And so that group of people, they had a group conscience meeting. One of the old-timers, who I thought was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Mac Shadburn. And Mac really ran Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a woman there. Her name was Jane. And Jane was, seriously, she had been sober since Christ was a child. And Jane was well into her 70s. She had white hair that was always pulled back in a perfect bun. She smoked cigarettes on an extender. She got carried into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous by newcomers. They had a wooden high back chair that was her chair, and they would take it out car side when she would get there, and they would load her in it, and they would carry her down the stairs into the basement of the church. I know, you can't make this stuff up. I'm just not that good. And they would carry her into the room, and they would place her right there where Shannon is sitting, right by the podium, and she got the only crystal ashtray in the whole place. And she would smoke these cigarettes on this extender, and people would just flock to her. And they would love on her, and she would hug them and knew something about them, and it was just like, duh. And I hated her. I hated, like, I didn't go anywhere near the front of the room. Who wants to go up there and be by her? And she would argue with Mac about what page something was on in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Mac always sat in the back. I can't see her name tag, but he would sit in the back by the door because he was the door tender. And the two of them had Alcoholics Anonymous locked down. They really did. You weren't coming in without going through Mac and his people. And you weren't going to stay in AA long if Jane didn't, you know, size you up and know a little something about you. And I'm coming in late every single meeting and making as much noise as possible because I'm in AA meetings and somehow I've decided it's your fault, so you're going to suffer. And it's a free-for-all in there, and I'm creating it. And every single time I get to know your tempo, right? I get to know how the meetings work. And I can tell when you people are getting ready to circle up to pray. There are some telltale signs that things are wrapping up. And when things start to wrap up, I'm up, I'm on the back wall, and I'm sliding down the back wall toward that door because I don't want to get too close to Mac. So I got to slide behind him to get out of the room because I'm not praying. Because I wasn't raised with God. I wasn't raised with prayer. I wasn't even sure that there really was a God. And you always said the Lord's Prayer. And there's a lot of words in the Lord's Prayer, and I don't know them. I don't know the words to the Lord's Prayer, and you're not going to pull my punk card like that. And so I'm sliding out of the meeting. And I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous like this against my will. I'm like sober 4 months. And I don't want to be sober because I got no tools for living life sober. I really don't. When I'm sober, my head is screaming and I am reliving every single thing that's ever happened to me. And I'm reliving every single thing that I've done to other people. And I don't have any tools for that. I'm not built for sober living. And I don't want it. But everybody's got me locked down, and I'm 15, and I don't have a lot of choices, so here I am. And Mac calls an emergency group conscience meeting. I don't know this, of course, because I'm not sticking around for any of that, but Mac calls an emergency group conscience meeting one night, and they all get together, and they have a discussion about what they're going to do with us. It's me and my sister. My sister's 17 at the time. What are we going to do with them? And Max says, I don't even think they're alcoholic. They got to go. Throw them out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, when you get somebody who's your leader, unofficially, in a meeting, you know, all of a sudden he had everybody going, yeah, 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 throw them out, throw them out, throw them out. And there was one guy, for those of you who are in service and you know anything about the minority voice, there's one guy in the room who never talked. His name was Bill. Bill never talked. And he was sitting in the back of the room. And for some reason, he piped up. And he said, you know, I figure that God gave them to us, therefore they are our responsibility. And he turned the room on a dime. And they said, well, what are we going to do with them? And so I'm sliding out of the meeting. meeting one night, and they had made some decisions about what they were going to do with us. I'm sliding out of the meeting one night, and Mac was not in his chair. He had taken his post by the door. And I ran into him. Physically, I ran into him because I'm looking that way, sliding that way, and I run into Mac. And I look over, and he's just standing there looking at me. And he said, "Get in the circle." So I went and I got in your stupid circle. And I bowed my head really low so that you wouldn't know that I didn't know the words to the Lord's Prayer. And as soon as the praying was over, I was back at that door, and Mac had not gotten in the circle. And he was filling up the entire door. And he just looked at me and he said, "Are you alcoholic?" And I gave him the only answer that I had at the time. And my answer was this. And he said, "Can you control your drinking?" And I gave him the only answer I had, which was this. Who tries to control their drinking? I mean, seriously. I take the cap off, throw it away, and I just drink until it's gone. And hopefully I've been crafty enough to steal or scam a backup bottle. Like, what am I going to do? Have a drink and take the edge off of my long day at school? Come on. I'm drinking. You know what I mean? Like, I'm in there. So there's none of this controlled drinking. I mean, you guys have entire meetings about controlling your drinking and all these ways that you try to control your drinking. I thought, that's just ridiculous. Can I control my drinking? Who knows? Who cares? And he reached in his back pocket. He handed me $5 and he said, "Here's $5. Go find out. We are tired of you treating Alcoholics Anonymous like a joke." And I went and I found my sister and I was like, "Go get your $5, man. We're out of here." That's all I had been waiting on, was someone with some authority to tell me I could go drink. And I finally got it. The president of Alcoholics Anonymous told me I could go have a drink. I mean, this is not a bad deal. It really isn't. But there was a caveat. There's always a caveat with these old timers. He said this. "Go try to control your drinking. If it doesn't work, you get back here. If it does work, I never want to see you again." And I was like, sweet. I have been sober against my will now for, I don't know, 4.5, 5 months, something like that. I'm certain now that I can drink and I can control my drinking. You know, I don't have to drink to oblivion. I don't have to cross the tracks. I don't have to go cause all of the strife and hate and discontent I've been causing. I don't have to do any of that. I'm just going to drink maybe half of what I've been drinking, half a fifth. I mean, I don't, you know what math is, but it's a reasonable amount to me, right? And I'm not going to have to do all of that, and everything's going to be fine. I had no idea that I was allergic to alcohol. I had no idea that once I put alcohol in my system, that my ability to stop consuming alcohol was going to be removed from me. I didn't know that that was my truth. So when somebody says, you know, "Are you alcoholic?" it's really important to know what your truth is. And because of that, I'm grateful that I got $5 and an explanation, because I went and I found out. I went and I found out. My relapse lasted one night. I had an equation. I was going to have 3 shots and 2 beers. To me, that was very moderate drinking. I was just going to take the edge off. Because here's the deal. When I was sober against my will, I had absolutely no relief at all from life. I had no relief at all from everything that was wrong in my life before I started drinking, from everything that was wrong in my life because of my drinking, from everything that I had done, from everything that I had experienced. I had no relief from any of it, and I was tired. I was exhausted. I remember telling someone I was exhausted when I was 10. When I was 10. I was exhausted when I was 10. My entire life I have lived with alcoholism. My entire life I have survived alcoholism. And I was tired. And that night I went out, I drank. It was very clear to me that the moment I swallowed alcohol that the switch got flipped and it was on and it was over. And I went into a blackout. Thank God I'm a blackout drinker. I remember enough. Thank you very much. And I went into a blackout and I came to the next day and I was sick. And I was black and blue and I was filthy and I had no idea what happened, where I was, how much I had had. I had nothing. But what I got was Max Shadburn's voice in my head that said, if it doesn't work, you get back here. And I had one little moment of clarity. And that moment of clarity, this is what I heard. You will always drink just like this. You will always drink just like this. I walked back into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was March 15th, 1987. Like I said, I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked all the way in and sat all the way down. And that group of people who had had that group conscience meeting, part of that group conscience meeting was they said, okay, Mac, you can throw them out, but what are we going to do if they come back? They're going to need somebody to sponsor them. And they were looking around the room and everybody was looking at the floor. You know, like, don't make eye contact, don't make eye contact. Maybe you won't get hooked into this deal. And there was another man in that room and he said, I have a feeling that these girls are pretty badly damaged. And I think the only people that are going to have a shot with them are those of us who are their grandparents' age. If you don't have white hair, you're probably not going to be very successful with them. And they all looked at Jane. And Jane said, I don't have the energy to sponsor those girls. I don't have the energy to do it by myself. And they said, that's okay. If you take them on, we'll all help. And so when I walked back into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that night, I went to leave that meeting. I got there on time. I sat in the middle. I had one cup of coffee. I got in your stupid circle. I went to leave that room, and Mac was in the doorway again. And he said, did you get a sponsor? And I said, no. And he said, you're not leaving without one. I walked up to every woman in that room and I said, will you sponsor me? And every woman in that room said, no, no. And so I went to leave the room and Mac was still in the doorway. And he said, well, did you get a sponsor? And I said, no one in here will sponsor me. And he said, that's a lie. I said, I'm not asking her. And he just went like this. And I walked up to the front of the room and I stood in line, which I hated. I waited my turn. I got up to Her Majesty. And I just looked at her and I said, will you sponsor me? And she looked at me and took a drag off that cigarette extender. And she said, why should I? And instead of telling her where to shove that cigarette extender, which was my plan, that's all I had. You know, like, you bring what you got, that's all I got. Instead of telling her where to shove that cigarette extender, I said, because I need to be sober and I don't know how. And I thought, who said that? And so Jane became my sponsor. What I didn't know is that I was going to become a product of group sponsorship. She didn't have the energy to sponsor me because Jane was dying of lung cancer. That's the reason that Jane was carried down the stairs into the basement of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, because she was suffering of lung cancer and didn't have the energy even to walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous by herself. So let alone trying to take on and sponsor a 15-year-old who was absolutely going to put her through the paces. And so that entire group conscience had divided up my life. I had a Monday crew, a Tuesday crew, a Wednesday crew, a Thursday crew, a Friday crew, a Saturday crew, and I wish I was kidding, and I wish that I had had a night off, but there was no night off. And the very next day after Jane had become my sponsor at 7 o'clock, there was an enormous vehicle that rolled into my driveway. Do you guys remember the Ford LTDs from the 70s? You can put 12 newcomers in the back seat. One of those cars comes rolling into my driveway, and I go outside to see who's in it, and they roll down the window, and I said, "Can I help you?" And they said, "Jane sent us. Get in the car." And the next night, 7 o'clock, here comes the car. Two different old guys and a different old Ford LTD. And I walk out to the car and I'm like, seriously, like I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous 2 days in a row, I'm good. And they just went, get in the car. And every single night, there's two old guys sitting in my driveway at 7 o'clock waiting for me to get in the freaking car. I'm like, I got it. I'm good. You know what I mean? Like, I'm good. I've learned my lesson. I really have. I've learned my lesson. I don't have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous every day. This is a little much. And I've had that conversation with them, and they just didn't care. And when they took me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, they didn't take me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and then take me home and drop me off as soon as it was over. Oh, God, no. No, you got to go to the freaking donut shop first. And you know what you do at the donut shop? You rehash everything that you just did at the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if there was a speaker, the inventory is taken. Oh, yeah. So I was never home before 11 o'clock at night, even on school nights, and somehow my ma was okay with that. And I'm hanging out with all of these old people. And I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night, and I'm going to donut shops across Northeast Ohio. And what happens at these donut shops is this. I don't talk because I have nothing to say of any value. But I am allowed to ask questions. Well, I don't have any questions because I don't want to know anything because I already got it figured out. And so I sit and I listen, and they tell their stories. And they talk about how they got sober. And they talk about how they began to pray. And they talk about their initial concepts of God. And they talk about how their lives have been completely restored. How they are now back in that normal, responsible place at their place of employment, in their family. How their buddies are calling them to go fishing again. How their daughters are calling them for Sunday dinner. And she hadn't called in 16 years for Sunday dinner. And they introduce me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous based on their stories. You see, we are masterful storytellers. We are masterful storytellers because we know that that is the one thing of true value that we bring to the table, whether we're sober one day, 1 year, or 30 years. My story is the thing of value that I bring to you. Now, I also got a big book. But we are masterful storytellers. And they would sit at that donut shop and we would rehash everything in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And they would tell me their stories. And they tricked me into working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They absolutely tricked me. Because I would start to get interested in their lives. And I would start to get interested in those facts that they would reveal in their stories. And I would start to ask them questions about how that kind of restoration came to take place. And they would say things like, well, it's the 12 steps, you know. And then they would just move on and tell another story. Well, it's the 12 steps, you know, and they would just move on and tell another story. And well, if you don't work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to die. And they absolutely tricked me into being interested in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what really happened was that I wanted to be part of the conversation. I wanted to be part of the conversation at the table at the donut shop. And I had no idea what they were talking about. And the only way that I was going to have any semblance of an idea of what they were talking about is if I got to experience it for myself. And so they tricked me. And I had a first step crew, a second step crew, a third step crew, a fourth step crew. Like, they were ready for me. They were ready for me. But I had to ask. I absolutely had to ask. They sat with me at the donut shop and they went through line by line the doctor's opinion. And thank God that they did, because the way alcoholism is described in the doctor's opinion, I belong here. I belong here. If I had to qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous based on days in jail, number of children had and neglected, number of marriages I had had, number of DUIs, any of the consequences of drunkenness that we seem to all have some experience with, if I had to qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous based on the consequences of my drunkenness, I wouldn't belong here. So thank God for the doctor's opinion, and thank you, Lynn, for talking about it so well. They enabled me to fully concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And I needed to know that this is where I belonged. And then they needed to convince me of the fact that I was, based on my powerlessness, they needed to convince me that I needed to be able to plug into some kind of a power greater than myself. I had to believe that there was something out there that was going to be interested enough in my life that I could plug into it too. I had to come to believe in something. And Jane didn't have a lot of spiritual language. When I asked Jane about the God thing, she said, God is good orderly direction. You don't have any, you'll be getting some, and it'll be coming directly from me. So I turned my will and my life over to the care of Jane for a while. Served me much better than doing it myself, by the way. So I became convinced by listening to their stories at the donut shop that this God thing was probably real. Because they said it was. And they showed me tangible evidence of a loving God working in their lives. Because the men that they described to me were not the men that I was experiencing over that cup of coffee and that donut. Those men no longer existed. And I thought, man, there's no way that these guys, if they were really like that, there's no way that they can get from there to here without something. So they had me convinced that there was something out there that was not only very, very powerful and interested in the lives of alcoholics, but would also bring a power that was based in forgiveness into my life and would forgive me for everything I had done. I know, right? That was big. That was big because I felt so filthy. I was so filled with shame when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of it, you know, my behavior brought to me. Some of it, others' behavior put upon me. But when I got here, I was dirty and I was heavy and I was filled with shame. And I was pretty sure that if there was a God, He wasn't going to have anything to do with me. And through listening to their stories, I became convinced not only that there probably is a God, but that He's big and He forgives big stuff. Because they shared with me their big stuff. And then they tricked me into praying. I started to take to the donut shop my enormous problems, because when you're 15 and 16, every problem is enormous, right? I mean, you take the regular adolescent crap, and then you pile alcoholism on top of it, and everything is earth-shattering. So I'm taking all of my earth-shattering things to the donut shop, like those guys could care. And all they would ever say to me was, "Did you pray about it? Did 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 you pray?" And I thought and finally one night I just looked at him and I said, "I don't know how." And he said, "Give me your book." And I slid my big book across the table and he picked it up and he opened it up and he started underlining and highlighting every tiny little prayer that is in the text of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He went through several pages, got lots of them underlined. He closed the cover and he slid it back and he said, "Pick one and try it." On your knees. And I was like, "Fine." And I went home and I put my book on the edge of my bed and I got down on my knees and I had to pray with one eye open because I needed to read the words. And I said the prayer, and then I opened both eyes, and I was like, "Okay, now what?" And I continued to do that day after day after day. And the problems that had piled up on me that seemed so difficult that I would never be able to solve them, all of a sudden they started to be taken care of. And my life started to get easier to live. And there started to be a flow and a give and take. And I don't have any idea how long it took, but instead of hoping that those guys didn't pull into the driveway, I started to wait for them to get there. And instead of hating that we were going to go to the Monday night Barberton speaker meeting, because, you know, those stupid people tell those stupid stories, all of a sudden I'm like, "Oh, it's Monday. We get to go hear a story. And then we're going to go evaluate it at the donut shop." I think back to those days, gals, and there are days when I'm just brought to tears just thinking about the faces of those old guys who showed up in my driveway and thinking about the love that they brought into my life by pulling into that driveway every single night at 7 o'clock, by the absolute grace that they showed me, by taking me not only to the meeting, but taking me to the donut shop. And they never asked me for gas money. I never had to buy my own donut because they knew how poor we were. I never had to do any of that. They just cared for me. And because of their care for me, when we got to the third step, and I had already been praying, and I was starting to see some measurable results coming from all of this weird new activity in my life, when we got to the third step, and they said that, you need to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of this God, I was terrified. But I already knew what it was like to trust something other than myself and to have it turn out okay. Because I trusted them. And my life was getting better. I trusted them with my problems and my secrets and my fears, and it was okay. They weren't betraying my trust, and they were caring for me. So when it came to the third step, I was terrified, but I was willing. I was willing. And the other thing was, I wasn't allowed to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous till I had done all 12, and so I really had to get 3 done. And I got down on my knees and I said the third step prayer like it's in the book. And I said it with Jane. And I got up off of my knees and I was like, "Okay, now what?" And she handed me a pen and paper. You see, I thought making a decision was just this verbal thing. I had no idea that making a decision was actually going to launch me into a course of vigor. Launch me into a course of vigor. Launch me into a course of vigorous action. I had really no intention of ever doing a fourth step. You know, like, I would probably put a couple of things down just to make everybody think that I was doing a fourth step, but I really wasn't going to do a fourth step. And now, all of a sudden, three is done, and I have a brand new notebook. And when we go to the donut shop, I'm not allowed to participate in the conversation until my writing's done. So I have to sit there at night at the donut shop, and I have to do my fourth step while I'm eating donuts and smoking bum cigarettes and drinking coffee at 10 o'clock at night. And that was my very first experience with step three. You know, the earth didn't open, nothing got shattered, you know, just it wasn't, you know, the oh experience. It wasn't any of that. But what it was an exercise in my willingness to do it. And my willingness then to follow it up with the rest of the actions. And I can tell you that exact same system has played out in my life over and over and over for the last 28 years. You know, surrender is really a process. Surrender is something that I have had the opportunity to do over and over and over. And every now and then, my concept of God changes so substantially that I go back to the third step again. And I ensure that the way my concept of God exists today, that I am willing, that I have complete willingness to actually trust Him. And so the third step for me has become this ongoing tool that I use in my life over and over and over and over. I mean, when I got sober, it was 1987, and there were crystals and runes and Ouija boards and all kinds of weird stuff going on in Alcoholics Anonymous, outside Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just this weird, new agey kind of time. And so people were doing all kinds of things, and their concepts of God were, you know, changing and emerging and becoming, you know, weirder by the day. And so I tried out a bunch of that stuff because I'm hanging out with AA people who are trying out a bunch of that stuff. And every single time I would try on someone else's concept of God, you know, there might be a little tiny bit of it that fit. And so I would keep that, and the rest of it I would let go. You know, I kind of liken it into going into a closet with all those old clothes to see what fits. And, you know, you might find one shirt that you're willing to wear again, and the rest of it, you know, really does need to get donated. And that's really what my spiritual growth was like for the first, you know, really couple of decades. And I would spend time with incredibly spiritual people whose lives made sense. And I would spend time with them, and I would get to know their concept of God and how they got there, and I would ask them questions, and I would sit at the feet of the giants in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would just gather everything they had to say, and I would try to enhance my spiritual practice. And I would try to, you know, keep an open mind, keep an open heart, and allow God to have His way with me. You know, I would try to allow... I just wanted to have an experience of God that was continuing to grow, because that's what's incredibly important here. And what I can tell you is that God has revealed to himself to me over and over and over in deep and expanding ways. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful. I really am. You know, how long have I been prattling on? Oh, we got to finish up soon. In 2000, and gosh, it's been 10 years. 10 years ago, every single person that I met was Catholic. 10 years ago, every new face in my life was Catholic. I mean, God was he was all over me. And I was not that happy about it. I really wasn't. I had never been part of an organized religion before. I just wasn't all that interested in it. I liked this free-floating thing that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my life was awesome. I was going to lots of meetings and sponsoring lots of people. And, you know, my career was great, and I had finished a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. And I'm just, you know, everybody's proud of me, and I'm proud of me, and I'm making plenty of money, and I'm paying my taxes. And, I mean, it's just firing on all cylinders. And all of a sudden, God is like... And I'm like, I hear you, but no. And he just keeps coming, and he keeps coming, and he keeps coming. And I end up finally having to make this final surrender and give up this final portion of my life. And I have to turn that over to him, and it's just incredibly painful. And I walk through all of that, and like I said, every new person in my life had become Catholic. And what I didn't know was that he was calling me into a deeper and more effective relationship with him. But that relationship and the structure of that relationship was about to change, because there was going to be a structure to the way I participated in that relationship with him. And I didn't want anything to do with that, because that was going to raise the bar on my behavior. Instead of telling my girlfriends about the mistakes I'm making and them going, well, there's spiritual consequences for that, and off we go. You know, now if I enter into this new relationship with God, now they're, you know... there really are spiritual consequences to that. And I want to continue to grow. And I know that, you know, the 11th step tells me that if I don't continue to do this deal, that it's over. And I have watched people in Alcoholics Anonymous absolutely make huge, huge monumental decisions, not grow, turn their back, walk away, and drink again. I've watched people with over 20 years of sobriety relapse because they're unwilling to continue to grow spiritually. And so once again, there's this new concept of God, and it is within the Catholic Church for me. This is my story. It's within the Catholic Church for me. And I'm going to Mass, and I'm doing the things that I'm supposed to do, and I'm sitting there, and I'm learning. And all of a sudden, I have this new concept of God. And I have to take it back to the third step and say, okay, based on this new concept of God that lives here, am I willing to trust him? Am I willing to trust him? And my answer to that was yes. Yes, I'm willing to trust him. And what he revealed to me over and over and over is, you can trust me. What I'm doing is I'm delivering you to a place where there are more spiritual tools at your fingertips so that you can participate in a more deep and effective relationship with me. And so I got baptized. I entered into the Catholic faith. My boyfriend at the time became my fiancé. He entered into the Catholic faith with me. He and I, we joined the church together, and then we married, and we did all kinds of things. And I got to experience God in this very new way and in this very new structure. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful, because today I have spiritual tools that I wouldn't have gotten had I not been willing to go there. You know, last week, there's a place in Spain, it's called Finisterre. And Finisterre is a spit of land that goes out into the Atlantic Ocean, and they used to believe that it was the point that was the furthest west. And Christopher Columbus, and in his day, I know Joe and Charlie talk about this a little bit when they do their big book CDs, but Christopher Columbus and the people of his day, they used to believe that the world was flat and that that was the end of the world, Finisterre. It was the finish of the land. And Christopher Columbus was willing to believe that indeed the earth is round and that I'm not going to fall off the end of it if I sail. He believed that the earth was round and that he would not fall off of the end of it if he sailed from Finisterre. And it's right there where I was in Spain. But that wasn't enough for him to stand on shore and say, I don't believe that that's the end of everything. Wasn't enough. He had to have the courage to get in the boat. He had to have the courage to get in the boat. And when he had the courage to get in the boat and sail over there, he got to experience the fact that the earth really is round and that he really wasn't going to sail off the end of it. And so when he came back again and it was time for him to take new ships and sail for new lands again. He no longer had to convince people based just solely on his belief, but he could present evidence to them that the world really was round. And to me, that's what step three is. Step three is just do it. You know, just get courageous. Get in the boat. Push off land. Trust the concept of God that you found in step two. Just trust him and see what happens. And when he gets bigger, go back and get in the boat all over again. And make sure that the new concept of God, that you can trust him the way you had the concept of God that you'd been using. And that has happened to me over and over and over. And today, I can tell you, getting in the boat and pushing offshore is the most amazing thing I've ever done. It's the most amazing thing I've ever done. And the reason that I had the courage to get in the boat and push offshore was because you were floating out there in your boats. And you told me and you showed me that I would be okay if I left land. So that whole, you know, going, you know, from reason to the shore of faith. Just get in the boat. Get in the boat. Let God become as big as he wants to become in your life. Push offshore. Be courageous. And pick up the pen. Thank you.
Wow, that was amazing.